welcome to another episode of We the People Radio. It's, let's see, it is April 19th, 2020.
There you go.
Still in lockdown, although we did go to the grocery store yesterday.
Still in lockdown.
And I think people dress up to go to the grocery now. I didn't see any slippers or pajamas yesterday.
So, actually, the grocery store was,
and it was
strangely
empty.
Quiet.
And it was freakish.
Yeah.
So, my name is Aaron Ryan.
My name's Bill Cundiff.
Who's our sponsor, Bill?
Well, our sponsor is Pape Machinery, our local John Deere ag and turf dealer. They're located at 3119 Twinview Boulevard in Shasta Lake City. And they handle full line of John Deere ag products and turf products. So if you need a mower, get in there and talk to them. They're going fast. I think moved about 15 mowers last week. Sun came out, grass is growing, and it's getting busy. So go in and see them. They'd love to talk to you about a new machine.
You can't get arrested for mowing now. Apparently, you can mow.
Yeah.
You can't body surf or whatever that guy was doing. You can't do that, but you can mow.
Right. That's right. You can keep the grass down. So,
and what if the power goes out?
Give them a call at 226-9226 or get them on the web at papemachinery.com.
What about the generators?
Oh, what about the generators?
They should plan ahead.
Yeah, they should.
For when PG&E shuts their power off this summer.
Let's talk about that.
Plan ahead because, you know, all you people who... How about this? All the people who weren't prepared for the toilet paper epidemic, you should be considering a generator now.
Yeah, because PG&E is going to shut your power off, and then you're going to be in the dark, and all those...
Actually, you're going to be in the heat.
All that hamburger you hoarded in the freezer is all going to turn sour, so you better get some way of plugging that thing in.
Good call. So, let's see. Oh, I was supposed to... there's always something I'm supposed to do that I forget. I was going to say that Robert has been kind enough to be putting our shows on camera, which is odd, you know. You think, well, who's going to watch a radio program? But you could just listen. You know, you could be doing stuff and just listen.
Apparently, we do have a face for radio.
So our faces for radio are now on TV on KRDT channel 23.7 on Tuesday nights. I do not have an exact time, but Tuesday nights don't last that long. So, you know, Tuesday nights.
And if your local dish network doesn't carry it, call them.
No, it's not one of those.
Oh, it's not one of those.
It's a regular. It's a regular channel. It's, okay. It's on the American Uncensored Network, and so in Reading, it's Tuesday nights.
Yeah,
actually, had someone call and say they saw us on.
Yeah,
TV.
Rabbit ears. Like, get your rabbit ears out. You can get us
to give some more thought into what I wear. You know, which black shirt should I wear this week? Yeah, that's a never-ending parade. So let's see, on the website, and I hope you use it because there's a lot of good information for you, especially on China. So for all those of you that are trying to decipher what's going on with this whole situation and who the players are, and just you want some background information on how that country operates and how they might have been involved in all this, you should go to wethepeopleradio.us and click on the China tab because we've got all of the shows linked on there. And we also have Eureka Young is going to give us an update on China and the virus next week. So anyway, spoiler alert. This week, however, we're going to take a complete departure from all of that. How nice is that? We're going to go along a totally different route. We're going to zoom up to Montana, and we're going to talk about the National Bison Range Giveaway. And for those of you who think it doesn't matter and you don't care about that, you actually do, whether you've ever been to the National Bison Range or if you ever intend to, because it has everything to do with water rights, bad federal agencies, you know, the stuff we love to talk about. So we will have adequate time to do that. And our guest is Skip Palmer. He's a retired U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service employee who, you know, caught them doing some bad things. He's got and some of the bad players actually in Montana have intersected with some of our bad players here in California that are working on taking out the Klamath dams and the water rights and all that stuff. So these things are affecting you. And even if your water comes from a faucet, it starts somewhere on property that you would like those water rights to continue. So it keeps coming out of your faucet. So Skip, with that, scattered beginning, you already told me what you used to do, but you didn't tell Bill, so maybe you could give him the rundown.
Are we still there?
Yeah, we're still there. There we go.
Okay. Do I'm retired U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, 23 years with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service at the National Bison Range. And it's a federal reserve, like all 563 in the United States. So what happens to this wildlife refuge could possibly happen to all of them, or most of them, including our national parks and some of those you have right there in California that will apply to this if it goes through.
Yeah, because this is kind of a bad direction, and it has the potential to be a precedent setter in the, I mean, for things that people may not really realize.
In the negotiations, they got a little excerpt that says that it doesn't, but it sure does, and the law doesn't allow for it to happen. What we're talking about is the Danes Tester Bill. It started with the Montana Water Compact and moved on to the Tester, from Tester to Danes Bill. And those bills both are allowing the government to give away water rights of thousands of people, and they do it under the cover of darkness. They're not being very forthright with what they're doing, and they sure aren't telling our county and our elected officials locally what they're doing. They've been asked, and they refuse to answer the questions. A little bit of information on, people may not understand what an Indian reservation is and how they're set up. There's different kinds of reservations. We happen to be on a open Indian reservation. An open Indian reservation in 1910, they opened the reservation to homesteading because there was not enough tribal members on it to justify putting in millions of dollars into infrastructure and a water project, irrigation project, to water the whole valley. And so we have a mixture of tribal and non-tribal folks here on our reservation. And you'll never know that you're on a reservation. When you drive onto it, there is the signs of poverty here are not there. You'll never know, you know, drive by the Walmart, the Kmart, you just don't realize that you're on our Indian reservation. Now, a closed Indian reservation, when they first set them up, they set them up with the purpose of only tribal members could be on them, and only the tribe could own the land. And they had 100% jurisdiction over that land. But with that being said, it didn't take long for the federal government to realize that what company or what factory or what business would move to a reservation and set up business if they couldn't own the land and they didn't have a vote in the government that controlled them. So they quit the closed Indian reservations and went to the open Indian reservations because they knew that it was a poverty-stricken situation when you did it that way. And what the federal government done to the tribes early on was dead wrong. And it was just dead wrong from the beginning, the way they set it up. They tried to fix it since, but the politicians got involved. And that's where it all went awry.
So on a open reservation, what say does the tribe have in local politics or land use?
The local tribe has their own tribal government. They have 10 tribal councilmen, which are their governing body. Only tribal members can be involved in that government. This tribe is very wealthy. This tribe has lots of land, lots of timber. They are involved in at least 16 corporations. They are more than a tribe. They are a gigantic corporation themselves that is being funded by the federal government through all of the programs for tribes.
Mm-hmm.
And so only about 30% of the reservation is owned by the tribe. The rest is owned by non-tribal members.
And how big is it? Like, give us some idea of, like, the size and how many people are just, you know, folks like you. You guys have been there for, you told me last night, but I've forgotten, your family's lived there for five generations?
Yes. I am the third generation of five generations on the same piece of property. My grandparents took the advantage of the Homestead Act shortly after. The property that they bought from a tribal member. Once the tribe, before they opened the reservation to homesteading, they gave each tribal member their own choice of land. They had 20 years for the tribe to come in here, and each man, woman, and child get to pick property. And then after each tribal member received their piece of property, the federal government considered the rest of it to be open and unclaimed. So that's when they had the Homestead Act of 1910, is when they opened the reservation to homesteading. And so the homesteaders came in and picked up the land that the tribes did not want. And then the federal government had plans already in place when they created the reservation to create the irrigation project to irrigate the valley floor.
Okay. At this point, let's take a really quick break. We're going to come back. And when we come back, we want to explain a little bit. I'd like you to explain to people why it would affect, or how this could affect, how about that, other sites around, you know, around the country, you know, how this is being done, because this isn't the first place they've tried this, correct?
Correct.
Uh-huh. Okay. So we have a kind of a systemic thing going on. We'll be right back with our guest, Skip Palmer. You're listening to We the People. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us.
Clenched in fists of rage, no angel born in hell could break that Satan's spell. And
all right, did we pick up where we left off at irrigation?
Yeah, we'll talk
about why you care.
Yeah, we were talking about how the land's been divided up, some tribal members, some homesteaders, and now the government's come in and they're going to irrigate the valley.
Yes, that's correct. And we'll start with explain a little bit of water rights. There's many different kinds of water rights. Here on our area, we have the Walton water right, and that is a court decision that was because of the Klamath, Colville tribe on the Klamath. The tribe claimed all of the water in what they called no-name basin. And it ended up going to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court settled that the water goes with the land, whoever owns that land. If you were a non-tribal member and you bought tribal land, that water right that that tribal member had went with that land. They could not separate it off. Just because that tribal member sold that land to you, the tribe itself did not retain the water. The water went with the land. So
okay,
that decision was settled.
But the homesteaders bought the land from the federal government, is that right?
Yes, the homesteaders bought the land from the federal government through the Homestead Act, but the money was paid to the tribe for compensation.
Okay, so when they bought that land, it came with water rights.
It sure did.
Okay.
It came with what they called secretarial rights and finally settled out as a Walton right. But a secretarial right... Secretarial right is if you have land and it has a natural stream that goes across it, or it has a pond on it, or you have a swamp that goes through it, that water is your water. That's a secretarial right that goes with that land that cannot be removed. How can you chop that water off when it's naturally there? So that goes with the land as a secretarial right. But the Walton right is the one that settled the issue of if the tribe retained the water and only sold the land. They did not. And that is going to affect you folks downstream from here. What's going on right now is the federal government is making a deal with the Salish and Kootenai tribes to use what they call time immemorial right, which trumps all other rights. And they want to put that water in the name of the Salish and Kootenai tribes in trust. That means the federal government actually owns it. The tribes are just the letterhead on the situation.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it's easier to deal with the tribes a one-on-one as far as the government goes than it is to deal with 10,000 individual water rights. So if they can get those water rights transferred over to the tribe, now they only have one entity to deal with, and all water runs downstream.
And right.
Without water rights nationwide through a consistent water right to make sure that everybody has a right to water, not one entity owns it. Otherwise, if they didn't have water rights set out all the way down the line, equal to everybody, the people on the end of that line, it wouldn't do you much good to turn your kitchen faucet on because there wouldn't be any water coming out of it because everybody would take what they wanted before it ever got there. And what are you going to do about it? So what a water right does is it only allows you to take exactly what you need to fulfill the purpose of irrigating your land. And so that way one person can't block it all up and hold everyone else at ransom.
Right.
They've dealt with that on the Klamath River, and it's going all the way down the line. The tribes are using their water right to protect fish.
Well, that's what they say, but I would beg to differ. Okay, sorry. That's the story.
That's the story. Yes, it is. Well, what it is control. They can use different groups can use different reasons. You know, we have the Ducks Unlimited, and we have the Trout Unlimited, and we have lots of organizations that are jumped on this bandwagon, and they are in favor of this Danes and Tester bill because they feel that it protects the fish or it protects ponds, it protects the ducks, and they don't realize when they do this how it's going to negatively affect the farmers and the ranchers and everyone else. Basically, they're looking out for their own interest, and that's the problem we've got with this situation, is the tribe and the federal government have used the divide and conquer way to do things very well. The tribes threatened to lay claims to 10,000 water rights on the east side of the Continental Divide, and we live on the west side. they said that that was their aboriginal grounds, so they should have the water right. Well, it spooked the farmers and the ranchers on the east side of this Continental Divide to the point where, well, we can't afford to take this on and fight 10,000 battles because, well, it's going to cost us too much. So the tribe says, well, we'll do a little negotiating here. We'll drop those water rights over on the east side of the mountains, and we'll just keep the water on the west side. It didn't take long for the west side boys turned on the east side boys, vice versa. Mm-hmm. And it was a good tactic for them, and it worked real well. But the boys on the east side don't realize that they actually didn't give up the claim to the 10,000 water rights. They just kept the claim to the headwater of the whole thing. So it doesn't make much difference now, does it?
Not really. And just so people know, when we're talking about the Tester and Danes, in case you're not looking at the members of the Senate closely, those are the two senators that represent Montana. And John Tester, he's been there since 2007, so he's considered a senior senator. And Steve Daines is he's the Democrat, Tester is. And Daines is the Republican. He's been there since 2015. So you're getting slammed both directions.
Yes. We got the Republicans and the Democrats both at this time working on this bill. The Tester bill started out as 262, and it made it through the state, but it died in Washington, D.C. Now Daines has picked up the same idea. He took basically the same bill, and he expanded upon that, and that's Bill 3019. And he added in some things that surprised everybody. They were going to trade state land on the reservation for state land off the reservation, and then they was going to give that state land to the tribe. Well, that state land, a lot of it is Section 36 for our schools. It has timber on it. Well, it's surrounded by tribal land. The tribes have not been willing to give the county and the state access to cut that timber to sell it to add it to the school funds, and that's what it was for. Now, after all this time, they're planning on trading that land off for something off the reservation to make sure that the tribes get more land on the reservation. When the county commissioners and a lot of other folks says, well, what are you going to trade for? Oh, well, we'll make that decision later. We'll have the Department of Revenue, DNRC, our department will take care of that for us. No, we want to know what you're going to trade our land that's got 100-year-old timber standing on it. What are you going to trade for? We're going to trade for some sagebrush somewhere or a rock pile? And that's money that we should be using for our schools, and you're willing to trade it off. They put wording in there that gave access to private property through the irrigation project. The irrigation project right now, the people who run the project, they have an easement to cross private property to maintain the canals and the ditches and the head gates, and that is fine, and nobody has a problem with that. But in this particular bill, they opened it up so that the tribes have access to private property. It doesn't say the people who work on the project, they could open it up and turn your yard into a freeway if your canals go through there, and there's nothing you can do about it. And when the county and ask about that, again, we got the blank stare, and we've received that a lot.
Because they either don't know, aren't saying, or they're in on it. How about this?
Or they do know and don't want to say.
Let's cliffhanger that. Let's give that the cliffhanger. We've got to take a really quick break. We'll come back with our guest, Skip Palmer, easy for me to say. And we're talking about the National Bison Range. You're listening to We the People. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us.
Oh, give me a home where the buffalo roam, where the deer and the antelope play. Seldom is heard.
discouraging word, and the skies are not cloudy all day.
One of those songs that we have to play at all the public meetings just to keep everyone on the same page. Just wanted to let you know, because we keep forgetting to announce it, but we are now on KRDT channel 23.7 Tuesday nights here in Reading on the American Uncensored News Network. It's a good thing it's uncensored, otherwise half our show would be missing, huh?
Yeah.
That'd be a drag.
Yeah. Okay. You're half.
Bill fights back. Was it the song? Did it make you? Did it empower you?
Yeah, it did.
Sorry, Skip. Back to you.
All right. Well, we are all wondering how and why Mr. Daines included the giveaway of the National Bison Range, a 100-year-old wildlife refuge, how he put it in a Water Protection Act bill. And we still haven't got an answer. He did say, well, they're separate. Well, if they're separate, why did you put it in the bill? Is it one of those things you slide through? This is too big to slide through. You know, just too many people paying attention to this. The National Bison Range was bought and paid for. It was paid for actually twice to the Salish and Kootenai tribes. It was a wildlife refuge that was put together by Teddy Roosevelt. It was the first wildlife refuge to take care of big game animals in the United States. And it's the Fish and Wildlife Service has done a great job of managing that wildlife refuge since its conception.
And I'm sorry, how big was that, range?
It's 18,600 acres.
Okay. That's a pretty good size.
Sort of.
I was one of the fellows that was lucky enough to get a job there. I applied for the job as a little kid growing up next to it. I always wanted to work there, always. And I applied for every job to come up, including the manager's position, and I was only 18 years old, but what the hell am I going to try?
Might as well.
And so after 20 years of trying, I finally received that job. And one of my jobs was I got the privilege of riding horse, chasing bison over 18,000 acres, running the bison into the corrals, working with all types of wildlife. It was a career that I felt very fortunate and very lucky to have. And when Daines introduced it in to this bill, he basically was going to give it entirely to them, the transfer. It says the transfer of other property. The secretary shall relinquish to the tribes any and all interest in the United States in the herd of bison located on transferred lands, and may transfer such personal property at this site appropriately. He's going to give it away. And when they relinquish all interest in the herd and the land, he turns around and says, well, the tribes promised to go ahead and treat it like a national, like it has been. They're going to keep it open to the public, and they're going to manage it for the benefit.
But that's not written anywhere.
It's not guaranteed.
No, that is not a guarantee.
We all know how verbal agreements work out.
Or on the paper, that he relinquished all interest. Well, you can't relinquish all interest on one paper and then turn around and tell the public, don't worry about it, we got it covered,
mm-hmm.
because they don't. And it's not that we don't trust the tribe to try, but it's not in the best interest of the American people to do it that way. Just like the National Bison Range being part of the refuge system, it's part of the park system. All the folks that have their park passes, when they buy the park pass to go to all over the United States,
right,
when they get to the National Bison Range, now they got to stop. Are they going to have to pay a special entry fee? Does that not count anymore?
Right.
And the bison on the National Bison Range, the genetics, they've been doing genetic work for years with the National Bison Range. We've taken bison from the National Bison Range, and they're on 6 different wildlife refuges right now. Plus, we've donated many of them to Native American tribes all over. They've started their own herds. And the genetics in the National Bison Range herd are, it's as close to pure as you can get. They were the wild bison. They never got mixed up with cows.
Right.
And so the genetics for the bison herd is very important, and we're still shipping those animals out into different places to make sure that we keep those genetics. How can the Fish and Wildlife Service just give that program up and turn that responsibility of preserving the bison, the national mammal, without any oversight?
How big is that herd?
It is down to about 270. It was at 450. In its early days, it was up to 800 before the war, but they slaughtered them down for the war effort, and not only for the war, but the carrying capacity of the range. They don't supplement feed anything. It's not like a zoo. The carrying capacity of the range determines how many animals,
right,
they keep on the range. And
is that number right for that size range, or can they?
How much room does a buffalo need?
Pardon?
How much, with horses or anything else, there's a certain space that there's a certain amount of space they need. How many buffalo can 18,000 acres carry? The amount they have, or can they carry more?
It can carry more as long as the invasive species and the noxious weeds are kept at bay, so that the native grass, which the bison thrive on, they could increase that population by correct management of the range itself.
And so who's doing that now?
U.S. Fish Wildlife Service is doing that now.
So they kick those guys out, and then who's doing it? Potentially nobody, right?
Right.
Great.
They need to upgrade their weed program. In our entire valley, we have a terrible weed problem. And the federal government and the National Bison Range is no different. But they haven't, in the last 10 years, they haven't put the money or the time or the effort into it to do a lot of those management concerns. Because when the tribes decided they wanted to be involved in the National Bison Range, they started out with what they called an AFA, an annual funding agreement, which meant that they wanted to take over some of the responsibilities, some of the management at the National Bison Range. And after many years of negotiating, they negotiated an AFA. And the first one failed miserably because the federal government, when they went into the negotiating table, they were basically, their hands were tied when it comes to dealing with Native American tribes, because the Native American tribes have a special and unique relationship with the federal government when it comes to negotiations. And it's always stacked in the favor of the tribes. And I can understand that. Look what the federal government done to the tribes 150 years ago. They really cleaned their clock. And there's lots of scrupulous people out there to take advantage of that. So they put these safety nets in years ago to protect the Native American. And now those same things they put in to protect them, they are now turned around and using those as a club against us and in the negotiation process. Example, in the annual funding agreement, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service folks that were always there, some tribal, some non-tribal, most of us worked there 15, 16 years together, fixing fence and grading roads and taking care of the animals and doing it all. So we had a pretty unique little working group, and we got a lot accomplished. And so when the government made the deal with the tribes over the AFA, one of the loopholes that they put in there was that if any Fish and Wildlife Service employee retired, transferred, or moved on, the tribe got to pick his replacement. And then they brought in their own management team, and the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service employees are now being managed by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife, by the tribe, but they're still being paid for by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. And then they brought in 10 of their own people so that we could train them on what we do and how we do it. And but with the tribe being able to replace the Fish and Wildlife Service employee if they decide to make a move, it put a target on the backs of all those Fish and Wildlife Service employees that as soon as we left, the tribes got to fill our position. And it turned into a nightmare because not that the tribal folks that worked with us were bad people at all. They had been listening to their leadership saying, well, you know, here in about 5 or 6 years, we're going to own that thing anyway. So basically, we'll do what we want. And so instead of following the instructions of the Fish and Wildlife Service on how they wanted the wildlife refuge run, they just ignored it to the point where it got out of hand and they did not accomplish what they were supposed to accomplish as a agreement. In the meantime, when I say they put the target on the back, some of the folks that worked for the tribe actually got mean, they got ornery, they were saying terrible, terrible things. Prime example, the YCC program has young kids all the way from 10 years old up to 16 years old that do summertime jobs. I walked into an office complex where the tribe held their morning meetings, and I heard two adult men talking, and they were using the F word, and they sounded like they were at the bar the night before, and they said they were at the night before. And I told him, I says, you guys can't talk like that in front of these kids in a government facility. I was told to my face in front of witnesses, including law enforcement, that we're going to own this place next year, so we'll talk any way we want. That's the kind of attitude that we had during this annual funding agreement.
Skip, we got to take a really, really fast break here again. Sorry, I keep interrupting. That's my job is to interrupt. I'm the official interrupter. So, bottom line is, it seems like everything you guys are told is some form of a fiction. We'll be right back. You're listening to We the People. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us.
Little white lies been around for years. Little white lies ringing in your ears. You turn around, come around back on you. Well, that little white lie's catching up to you.
wish of jumping that paddle wheel bumping. Black water keep rolling on fast just the same.
Oh, black water keep on rolling.
Mississippi moon, won't you keep on shining on me?
Oh, black water keep on rolling.
Mississippi moon, won't you keep on shining on me?
Oh, black water keep on rolling.
Mississippi moon, won't you keep on shining on me?
Couldn't possibly do a show about water and not use that song. All right, Skip. The interruption is over.
At this point in time, I would like to insert, considering I'm third generation to five generations living on the reservation and working with Indian people, I get very upset when I hear people say that they're lazy and they're drunk or they're stupid. Or I'm telling you what, the tribal people here are nothing but the best. They try their hardest. These folks work terribly hard for what they have. The average Native American, he's like everybody else. They struggle and to get by, and they're hard workers. And I wanted to put that in there, that, you know, they're all friends of mine. It has nothing to do with the tribal member. This is their government and our government making deals and leaving both the tribal folks and the non-tribal folks out of it. Apparently, we're all too ignorant to be involved in what they're going to do to us. And with the AFA process, it was negotiated incorrectly. The tribes got basically excommunicated off the bison range because of an investigation showed that the tribes were harassing, and the Fish and Wildlife Service was not correcting it. And that was their job to correct it. Our grievance was not with the tribes. Our grievance was with our very own agency that knew what was going on and let it continue because they did not want to rock that political boat. And so it was a bad situation. They tried it again, another AFA after that one, but they did it without doing the correct and proper paperwork. And that was when an organization, PEER, sued for an environmental assessment of what was going on. And it got canceled because of the PEER lawsuit. Plus, the second time around, they had some issues with feeding the bison. And just it was a lack of communications because it was a bad negotiated deal. So basically, the annual funding agreement went away, and that's when the tribes suggested a transfer. Well, it didn't happen for a while, and everybody thought it was not correct. But the pressure got put on politically from the tribe to Washington, D.C., and from Washington, D.C. to the regional office to start the process. And so the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service started the process of the giveaway. But they didn't tell anybody what they were doing. They kept it to themselves, and because they knew that the uproar would be too much. So they didn't tell the American public what they were up to. And we had senators, we have congressmen, we have management authority in the Denver office, all going behind the doors and trying to put a deal together to give it away. But at the same time, a lawsuit required the Fish and Wildlife Service to do what they called a CCP, that's a conservation long-term plan. What are you going to do with the wildlife refuge for the next 15 years? All wildlife refuges in the United States had to have one. They all had one. the National Bison Range was the last one. And the reason they didn't want to do it is because they were planning on giving it away, and they didn't want to make a plan that the tribe would have to follow. They wanted the tribe to have their own plan. But instead of telling the public that they were doing a giveaway at the same time they were doing a required CCP, they involved the state, they involved our county commissioners, they involved the county commissioners in the county next door, they involved the Montana State Fish and Game. These people spent days, hours, and weeks following government protocol to come up with a CCP plan. At the whole time, the Fish and Wildlife Service was making the giveaway plan in the background. And in the CCP plan, there should have been an alternative. There was five alternatives. One of them should have been, if we're going to give the National Bison Range away, what is your opinion? How do you think it should be done? In what order should you think it should be done? They left that section of the CCP completely out, as if they didn't know what was going to happen. So it was a false flag. They let the people think that they were doing the right thing. At the same time, they were sneaking in the back door.
Wow.
And we see that other places. I mean, you would think that using tax dollars, that they would have to be transparent and working with the public, but very often, because we see this on the Klamath, they have these meetings, and then you hear that there are other meetings that are taking place with federal agencies and state agencies, state officials, in our case, Oregon and California. They're having all these secret meetings, and you hear they're kind of cutting a deal in the background, so they're just keeping everybody else busy. Just like your deal. I can't believe we're the only two places in the country this is happening.
Well, I'm sure it's happening other places too, but it's a big one here because the old saying, stuff runs downhill, and that includes the water.
Mm-hmm.
And but the Fish and Wildlife Service has not been very honest with the public on what their plans are. And they have the other places they would like to spend their money. And so for them, instead of doing the fight the battle for the American people, it's easier to give up and move on. And one of the situations we have that's pushing this forward is the tribes have this straight connection to our senators and our congressmen. They've got many, many lobbyists. They've got attorneys that are on staff at all times that do nothing but set this kind of stuff up. And they will start the process of, well, we want to negotiate for this. Then, when the negotiations come to a standstill or they get stuck or it's not quite what they thought, they call up their senator. They call up their congressman, that senator. He writes a letter to the to the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, people like Dan Ash, and say, hey, the tribes are telling us that you guys aren't being very cooperative with them here, and I'm getting some heat and some pressure on this thing, and I need it taken care of. Now, you get to work and you take care of business. So then Dan Ash, he calls down to the regional office and says, hey, okay, you guys, I'm catching static from the senator. You got to do something different here. Start negotiating.
And that rolls downhill, too. Gosh, you know, it's a common theme, I guess.
Gee,
gravity.
Golly whiz.
Gravity's doing well. We'll be right back with our guest, Skip Homer. Skip, you got 5 minutes to find coffee or whatever. You're listening to We the People. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us. Was Bill making all the noise, by the way? Oh, and that big crash you heard earlier, that was Bill, too. Welcome back to the second hour of We the People Radio. My name is Aaron Ryan.
And my name's not Aaron Ryan. I'm Bill Cundiff. And our sponsor this hour is Pape Machinery, our local John Deere ag and turf dealer. You can visit them at 3119 Twinview Boulevard in Shasta Lake City, or call them on the phone at 530-226-9226. Give them a call. Anything tractors or turf equipment, they've got it more than likely in stock and ready to go. Is the season for grass, so things are starting to dry out. You're going to have to go out there and start turning the ground and mowing and all that fun stuff. So go by and see them. You can also get them on the web at papaymachinery.com. They got a good website there, very interactive. Papay Machinery.
There you go.
Yeah.
Yeah, generators, tractors. And for heaven's sakes, mow your grass early this year. We can't afford to have a bunch of fires.
That's
again.
Right.
It's ridiculous.
And also, they're now a steel dealer. So if you need a string trimmer or a chainsaw or hedge trimmer, they've got it all in stock. Just go in there and pick something out.
Mosey around. They're open because they're essential.
Yes.
We should bring that up.
That's right. They are essential.
They're essential.
Yep.
And interestingly enough, for all you essential businesses out there, apparently OSHA is showing up at people's businesses, and they walk in and say they're from OSHA, and then they stick their hand out, and if you shake their hand, then you get busted.
Yeah, that's a violation of the health safety code.
How great is that?
Yeah, so I'm just there to help.
If OSHA shows up, don't touch any of them. Ever.
Yeah, ever.
It's not good. It's going to cost you. Oh, my gosh. Well, We the People Radio is now on television, which I know sounds confusing, but it's kind of fun. I've had some people call and say that they, I don't know, we haven't had a lot of antics lately. You know, Bill hasn't really been headbutting the microphone. We've been pretty tame. But you can catch all that on KRDT Channel 23.7 Tuesday nights on the American Uncensored Network here in Redding, California.
There you go.
Go figure that out. So our guest today is Skip Palmer. He is a retired U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service guy who lives on the National Bison Range in Montana, and he is they had five generations of their family. He is the third generation to be living on the bison range. And, hey, so Skip, when you're not, you know, when you're retired and stuff, what do you do there? Are you like a cattle guy or, you know, you just hanging out?
No, I got a mob of horses.
Horse guy.
Oh, yeah. But by the time you water the grass, raise the hay, cut the hay, bale the hay, pick up the hay, stack the hay, wintertime comes, you got to feed the hay. It keeps me busy. And they're just plain old horses. We're mountain kind of guys. We do a lot of packing and hunting in the mountains and a lot of fish trips in the summertime. And basically, they're just plain horses, nothing fancy.
Well, that's
but
fun.
But it does keep me busy.
That sounds like
I'm an inlay. I have 20 acres. I was raised on a dairy, 300-acre dairy. My dad was very successful at the dairy business. When he retired out, we tried to decide what we was going to do with our land. And my dad had always managed his land quite well. And the subdividers wanted it real bad to chop it up, and Dad wasn't into that. So he asked the Montana State Fish and Game if they would buy it for wildlife habitat because our property borders them and always has. And through some wheeling and dealing, we ended up selling the family farm to the Montana State Fish and Game to add to the wildlife refuge. And the Montana State Fish and Game could not pay subdivision price, of course, subdivide price. So my dad, over the years, had gathered land. He actually paid $1,100 for 40 acres just before the war, World War II, and he paid for it with skunk pelts. They trapped skunks all winter long.
Oh, boy.
And for the war effort. And that's how he paid for it. So I asked him, I said, what is capital gains going to do to you on this situation if you sell to the subdividers? And so basically, the county, the state, and the federal government wrote off Dad's taxes so that he sold it for an agricultural price and got to write the taxes off. So he got to put the same amount of money in his pocket as if he would have sold to the subdividers. And now our family farm is part of the wildlife refuge. and I happen to be a 20-acre inlay in that. So I manage my property for wildlife.
So if the geniuses up in your area do give the bison range, hand it over to the tribe, then that property that your dad sold that borders your property is no longer necessarily managed for wildlife. They can pretty much do anything they want with it?
Well, that is one of the questions that has been asked by our county commissioners to the state of Montana and to Senator Daines, and they will not give us an answer. It goes through the way it appears is what they want it to go through. This land would be managed as by the tribe, and they don't have to treat it as a wildlife refuge. They could have put a subdivision on it if they want. That was an understanding between my dad and the Montana State Fish and Game when he sold the property, that he was selling it to them for the purpose of wildlife. But that doesn't mean the next owner has to abide by that.
That's right.
So it's all up for grabs. And that was a legitimate question that many people ask about our state land, and they got no response. It was one of those, we'll let you know when we pass a bill, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Sort of like Obamacare. You got to pass a bill to see what's in it.
Mm. So is subdivided land in high demand in your area?
Yeah, it is. It's not because we're rolling in jobs around here. They're taking the family farm, which was about 250 to 300 acres. They are not big enough anymore to support the grandpa and grandma and dad and the next generation. So a lot of those farms are being broke up into smaller tracts with one house on it. So that's the way it's going, is we're getting a lot of single-family homes around us on what used to be family farms. We'll now have three houses to four houses on it.
Right. Hmm. So the tribe has not given any indication of their plans for that refuge if it's transferred. They're keeping that all pretty close to the vest, huh?
Yes. At this point, we don't even know. We don't even know if it's in the negotiations, because they won't. Nobody will tell us. The Montana State Fish and Game, when they are asked point blank, well, we don't know. What do you mean you don't know? It's your agency. It's your land, and you don't know if it's on the chopping block.
Yeah, that's totally believable.
You look at them with this blank stare, like, how can you possibly not ask those questions? As being the director of the Montana State Fish and Game, why have you not asked that question? Why haven't you forced an answer from somebody? But they don't. They're sitting back and see where the chips fall.
Hmm. So are there other bison ranges in Montana, or is this it?
No, this is the National Bison Range, federal. There's lots of private buffalo herds. Right now there's the big issue with the Yellowstone herd roaming out of the park and going north and getting on private property. And so they've been capturing them and transferring them to native tribes that want to start their own bison herd. And so that's been working out quite well. But now we have a group, the Nature Conservancy, they want to take 750,000 acres in private property, plus the 1.6 million acres the wildlife refuge over there on the Fort Peck Reservoir, and turn it into a gigantic open range bison thing for a wild bison. And that is a huge issue here in Montana at this point in time. you know, to just bring all the bison from Yellowstone and just turn them loose and let them go where they want. I guess you know that has caused a bit of a stink.
Well, yeah.
I would imagine so. Let's take a really quick break here, and we'll be right back with our guest, Skip Palmer. You are listening to We the People Radio. You can listen to us online, wethepeopleradio.us. We've got commercial-free archives for you on all of our programs going back 10 years. And you can also catch us on the KRDT channel, 23.7 channel, Tuesday nights in Reading on the American Uncensored Network. There you go.
Progress came and took its toll.
Look for the bare necessities, simple bare necessities. Forget about your worries and your strife. I mean the bare necessities, Mother Nature's recipe. Bring the bare necessities of life.
Couldn't talk about Yellowstone without a little Satchmo.
Yeah, a little Satchmo.
Oh, it just seemed wrong to skip it. So with Yellowstone and all these other places that there are bison, if they screw up the National Bison Range and lose that genetic control, do they just go away?
They would lose it. They would lose the genetic control of that herd.
So there's kind of a lot at stake here.
And that genetic herd is very important. It's been part of the, like they call the meadow population study, and they've taken blood samples of all the herds in the United States under federal control, and to make sure that they don't have cow genes in them, you know, some they didn't get mixed up somewhere. And it's very important to make sure that we have pure bison, and that's just part of it. But we will lose that control. They say they will, but there's no guarantee. And there's
no recourse like there would be with a federal agency. I mean, people could file complaints and all that stuff if they felt it wasn't being managed properly. But once the tribe has it, nobody has a say.
Correct. The federal government has given up all control. And if you try to ask them, or you can't even take them to court, if you see something blatantly wrong, you're not going to get them to court. They don't have to go to court. You cannot do that. That's one of the things that is wrong with this whole situation. Back to the water part. They redesigned the highway going across the reservation, and the tribes insisted that a complete NEPA be done before they turned the first shovel of dirt. That took 10 years to do a NEPA to make sure how much wetland they were going to destroy, where the road was going to go. The tribe had the input on what was going to happen. Lots of different stuff before they ever turned the first shovel. Here we are with a water project where they're planning on giving the tribes control of all the water from the top of the mountain, clear across the valley floor, and out the other side, the water that ends up going down to you folks and the people down in the Columbia. They're not requiring to do a NEPA. We have no idea what the tribes plan to do in their reconstruction of the irrigation project, which in the Danes bill gives them millions of dollars to do. They don't have to tell the farmer what he's going to do, or the rancher, or the landowner. If there's a small canal that goes through your place and they want to carry more water, they could eat a swath across your place and do whatever they want, and you don't know about it until the machinery show up. And
wow.
So we need a NEPA, an environmental assessment, on what the tribe is going to do to our water project if Dane's bill goes through.
And how many people are affected by that project?
Here on the all the people on the reservation, over about 45,000. Yeah, there's a lot of people involved, and that's just on the reservation. This Dane's bill goes off the reservation. It takes water right from the Hungry Horse, miles off of the project itself. Some of our folks up in Kalispell, I don't think they understand how important this is to them. They are upstream from us. The tribes have control of the water. Now they can use their EPA standing with the Clean Water Act, and now counties north of the reservation will be applying for building permits from the tribal council on the Flathead Indian Reservation. It's just a big can of worms that nobody's looking at the final outcome, what the repercussions of this could possibly be. And the Danes and Tester folks are not turning that information out, and when we ask the question, we do not get the answers.
I wonder if they've done the homework on it. I wonder if they even know.
Well, obviously they haven't, because I'm looking at the bill on congress.gov. It's Senate Bill 3019, the Montana Water Rights Protection Act. So, what we've been talking about.
Yeah.
It is huge here, and I think a lot of the folks that are in charge do know, but they're not letting their constituents know, no more than Danes and Tester are letting us know. We have to figure it out on our own. That's the reason I and a small group finally had enough, and we had to hire ourselves a very nice attorney. And with all the information that we'd gathered over the years and all of the FOIA requests that were sent out, we learned a whole lot in a big hurry. And there's a lot of people out there in some very important positions that should be ashamed of themselves by letting this thing happen. They could have spoke up when they didn't. Our county commissioner should have spoke up a little earlier. They're wonderful. Wonderful bunch. They're between a rock and a hard spot, considering in the county we have tribal folks and non-tribal folks, so that this county commissioners have to walk this fine line. They can't spend a lot of money fighting a issue that maybe half of the constituents are for.
Right.
The good news in looking at the detail here that's very thin, on congress.gov, the bill was introduced on December 11th, 2019. It has one co-sponsor. It was introduced by Senator Steve Daines, and its sole co-sponsor is Senator John Tester. Mm. So the two of them are out, really riding the range alone on this deal, and it hasn't had any sort of action. It's been referred to the Senate Indian Affairs Committee, so if you get lucky and there's no related bill in the House so far, you might run out a year, and it may die a slow death.
Well, if we can shine the spotlight on it, we don't have the problem up here up north, but I've spent some time down south. Sometimes you walk into a place that wasn't very well kept, and you turn on the kitchen light, and you can see the floor make a run for it. And basically, that's what we're doing. Is when we got our attorney, we told him that, and we ended up getting an attorney out of New York City.
And he's actually on the other line. We're gonna.
Very good. I'm glad to hear he's hanging on.
Yeah, we're gonna roll Larry Kogan in here in a minute. And for those of you,
we had the issue with all of our local attorneys in the state of Montana have already been represented, or they have an inside glitch, or they're connected to, or they're related to somebody in the state of Montana. We told our attorney that we wanted him to go out and follow the leads, and we don't care who is the light shines on. We aren't going to pick somebody out. Don't go over there because he's my friend. if you're guilty, we want you in line. And that's where we're going with this thing. And we hope that we shine enough light on this thing that the Bison Range part of it dies. But we've still got the water issue that is just as bad as the Bison Range issue. And I want your folks down your part of the country to know that this will eventually run downhill to you, because what happens here on this water compact and the Bison Range giveaway is precedent setting, because there's too many tribes out there waiting to see exactly how this is going to go down, because it opens the door opportunity for them to do basically the same thing. And when it comes to the water, it's all a matter of control. Whoever controls the water controls everything.
Yep.
And I feel sort of sorry for the tribes sometimes, because I think the federal government is using them. They're using them to get all of the water assigned over to them, basically. And it's going to be a lot easier 20, 30, 40 years from now to go ahead and say, well, guess what? Your trust responsibility, we done changed this. We put an act in there that we need that water somewhere else. And it's ours, because you helped us take it away from those private landowners and put it in our coffer. And I just feel that the tribes are being used on it in some manner.
Yeah, and what we see in our area is a lot of co-opting with the environmental groups, and I'm sure that they're not absent in your neck of the woods either. Let's take our break like just a teensy bit early, and then when we come back, we can conference Larry in, just so that we can have time for that. Because Larry's always very entertaining. You're listening to We the People. Join us online, WeThePeopleRadio.us. There's no better introduction for Larry Cogan than that song.
How are you, Larry?
So, Mr. Cogan, talk to us about your side of the situation up there in Montana.
Well, you know how they like New Yorkers in Montana, huh?
Yeah, they love them. They love New Yorkers everywhere, and especially now that President Trump's in. People are really loving New Yorkers. You're kind of faint.
With all that.
You're very faint, which is un-New Yorker-ish for you. You need to be louder, as you've never heard that before.
Well, you know, I'm traveled out of New York, and therefore I have like a broader perspective. And, you know, and if once you get a New Yorker on horseback for 8 hours and he didn't fall off, okay, then I could start crowing a little bit. But the Montanans speak the poor tongue without a doubt.
Skip just did a tell-all there. Good one, Skip.
I was on horseback herding 200 head of cattle in Klamath, Oregon in 2016 May, and they tried to get that horse to gallop and knock me down, but it didn't happen. Although I have to admit, I had the most painful night of sleep I ever had in my life.
Felt a little bow-legged, did you?
I don't know what it was. My body had gone in directions that it hadn't gone in since I was a kid, you know. But I didn't end up on the ground. That's all that mattered. and I was able to stand tall the next day after my bowled leg straightened out.
Well, the only the only good part of that, Larry, is your significant other can put some grease on the saddle sores.
You're right. I'm glad that they tied the saddle on tight, too.
This is going down a dark trail.
On the side of the mountain that I was walking on, riding on. But, no, the story of Montana's water compact just continues. It doesn't go away because the Confederated Sailors and Kootenai tribes think of themselves as celebrities. They're like the Hollywood tribe, you know? They're the first federally recognized tribe out of 567, so they believe they're entitled to go back in history and recreate their Aboriginal territory. And unfortunately, the federal courts out west in the Ninth Circuit believe in this nonsense, and they've been empowering and encouraging these types of tribes, including in the Klamath region, to assert themselves and to claim that the federal government owes them a big one under this federal trust obligation. And because of that, under the Obama administration, which was a champion of this federal trust obligation, that we found actually goes back to the 19th century, early 1830s. There were three Supreme Court cases in the 1830s. A trilogy of cases that actually articulated the federal trust obligation from international law at the time. And they cited a French international law expert for the proposition that strong countries need to protect weak, non-functioning peoples. And where do you think the UN trusteeship notion came from? That's the same notion. So the tribes are dependent sovereigns, dependent on the United States government, which, if they didn't have that kind of stewardship by the U.S. government, these tribes would be pretty much SOL. And the money's coming from Congress. And the money's then get circulated among the congressional delegation of Montana. So, you know, one hand washes the other, wink, wink, nod, nod, and everybody's in on the same game. The only problem is that they don't tell the people of Montana what's going on, especially on and near the reservation. Mm. They have to find out for themselves, and then when they think they've got allies, advocates, the advocates do not really tell them the truth. They tell them we're going to help you, and then it ends up their money is spent, and they're not any better off than they were before. You know, they stage fake press releases and press announcements just to make people believe that they're doing something for their constituents and that nothing happens.
Wow.
And it's unfortunate because they take advantage of these people. I mean, they're not as well educated as the, pardon me, the legal community in Montana. It's a small legal community. And, They take advantage. Now, the question is, why would they do that? We haven't really figured out the answer to that yet, though it has to do something with the natural resources. It's either the water or it's the minerals, or both.
We haven't even talked minerals.
They must get a piece of the action. I mean, one thing that we found during the writing of the FOIA request was that the former Deputy Attorney General under Mr. Fox was he retired from the Attorney General's office, and he ended up having a very big interest in a mineral mine near Billings.
Huh.
Now, that is pure coincidence, isn't it?
I'm sure.
Did he have any political influence, maybe? Possibly. Did he have any friends there willing to do a quid pro quo? Possibly. Can't prove anything. I'm not even alleging it. But it does smell, doesn't it?
Yeah, especially, the thing that always bugs me the most about all of this is that the taxpayers are fighting all of these people. Could be their county folks, could be the state representatives, federal, the agencies, all of those people are paid with their tax dollars. So they are financing a giant multi-pronged force that's coming at them full blast, and they've got to finance their own defense as well.
Well, plus they're, you know, one thing I learned about farmers and ranchers out west is that everybody likes to stand strong on their own. They don't like to have to depend on other people.
That's true. It's not a group sport.
Right. So, you know, when they're out on their own and then they get split by these, you know, exploitationists, opportunists, they get split into subgroups and they don't have any strength in you know, in the few numbers that they are. And then they, you know, argue with each other and they never get anything accomplished.
Is that happening in Montana too?
Oh, yeah. You know it's happening in Klamath when we were there all trying to fight the agreements that the Obama administration, first the Bush administration introduced, then the Obama administration tried to seal the deal. And they didn't want to admit that it was just another form of an interstate compact which would require congressional ratification under the Constitution's clause for interstate compacts. But they would never allude. They would never allude to it, and they would never admit it once it was. They were confronted with that issue, and then they get the tribes all excited. Now, it's wrong to blame the tribal members really for anything other than trying to assert their rights to being treated as equal Americans.
Well, a lot of times, though, it's just the leadership, because I know that many of our tribes up north, the members of the tribe know that, like in our particular fight, taking out the Klamath dams will actually hurt them downriver. The tribal members know that, but the folks running it that are in their tribal council, they're, you know, I don't know what their gain is on that, but they're bound and determined to be a party to getting rid of that. And the other thing we learned from Elaine Willman years ago when we first, you know, met all of you guys and started learning about Montana, she had told us that didn't really matter which reservation, if you cross the tribal council, you pay a price.
Yes. And actually, Elaine is coming out with a new book, by the way.
Oh.
In fact, I think she would be very happy to come on your show to promote it once it's available during early summer.
Okay.
It's entitled American Tribal Tyranny. That's what it's entitled. And it's, from what I understand, it's going to be a really rich read. And I think it's something your audience would want to hear about.
Nice. And in this particular, in the Montana situation that Skip has been telling us about, you don't just have federal folks and state folks. You have some of the local, not necessarily elected representation, but maybe council for that has also kind of shot him in the back.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's the same thing as in Klamath, okay? We have the federal, you know, authorities in the various regulatory agencies that have jurisdiction over the various aspects of the project or program they're trying to push. Then you got the state officials that are in bed with them. Then you got the local yokels that want the federal money. They want the federal welfare, and they don't want to farm anymore. They're getting older in age, and you know their kids don't want it. So they want to take the money, and they work against the farmers that do want to continue to farm and pass this legacy onto their families, but they don't do it honestly. They do it behind your back, and they claim, how could you trust an outsider when we're all neighbors?
Right, even though they're cutting a side deal in a back room.
It's like they pretend that it's Mr. Rogers' neighborhood, and then they cut you in half when they're outside your presence. And they work against you. It happened in Montana when we tried to address the dam transfer issue, when we tried to address the water compact. And now with respect to the bison range, it's the same thing. you have the entire Montana congressional delegation actually sent in letter requests to the Fish and Wildlife Service seeking technical assistance in the drafting of legislation to help the tribes obtain the transfer of the bison range. It's on paper. The FOIAs, it's in the FOIA responses. And it's rather amazing that all three of them were involved. Danes, Mr. Tester, of course, and then Mr. Zinke. Mr. Zinke is a comedian's dream, because he does have two sides of his mouth that from which he speaks. Depends upon who's in the room. And the fact that he came out in 2017 after the expressed official policy of the Fish and Wildlife Service was, we're going to transfer the bison range rather than try to negotiate another advanced funding agreement with them. And it's okay if we do, because this is a unique situation and it's reparations of sorts. He said, no, that's not our policy. We're not going to give away. I said we're not going to transfer or sell any federal land, and I meant what I said. The problem is, he doesn't have any power over that. It's not his call. It's the Congress's call.
It's good to stand tall on someone else's decision. We have to take a really quick break. I will have to exert my fun killer powers here. We'll be right back to talk about the National Bison Range.
Everything, well, I can try. And as I roll along, I begin to find things aren't always just what they seem. I wanna turn the whole thing upside down. I'll find the things they say just can't be found. I'll share this love I'll find with everyone.
That whisper singing, that was Bill.
That was me.
Just by the way.
Hey, I have a question. We've talked a lot about the Fish and Wildlife Service and their management of the bison range. My question is, why would they support a move to lose that control or give that control away? What's their agenda?
Well, every federal agency, Bill, has a legal and fiduciary obligation under this notion of tribal fiduciary trust obligation to defer to the preferences of the tribe and the needs of the tribe whenever possible. That includes even sacrificing the mission statement of the federal agency to some extent in order to appease the tribes. In this particular case, the tribe has claimed that this was part of its historical territory. It's a reservation, actually, within a reservation. Okay, in 1855, with the Hellgate Treaty, the federal government reserved land for the tribes in exchange for the tribes giving up all of its old territory. And in 1908, former President Theodore Roosevelt set aside land within the Flathead Indian Reservation as a natural preserve for bison. Bison were almost extinct at that time in history. The tribe had their own bison herd, and they were losing the herd. They weren't stewarding it properly. So in order to preserve the species, this refuge was established. Then was enlarged. First, it was established to be no more than 12,800 acres. They then increased it in size to up to 20,000 acres. And that became the bison range in 1908, and then it was expanded in 1921, I believe, by former President Harding to include migratory birds as a refuge within the refuge. So you have a reservation, and whenever you have that reservation, you're really talking about either Article, you know, the property clause of the United States Constitution. And essentially the federal government holds federal land in trust for all Americans throughout the nation in perpetuity so that people can enjoy and use these federal lands for purposes of recreation and to learn about nature. The tribe wants this land back. They want to reestablish their old historical territory before the state of Montana was formed, before the United States was formed. Pre-European discovery era is aboriginal. Okay, and they use the term aboriginal, and somehow the courts in the Ninth Circuit have used that term and given it credibility. If taken to its logical extreme, we wouldn't have a United States of America anymore.
Right.
Because every tribe would reassert its aboriginal territory rights. No more 50 states. Or they wouldn't look nearly the same as they do now. Now, tribes don't have any obligation under the tribal sovereignty doctrine to adhere to abide by the United States Constitution because, as the reasoning goes, they were here before the Constitution was formed. Now, what does that mean for all of us? For the entire country, as a nation, as a civitas, what does that mean?
It means we're going to fund public land and lose access.
Right. They have no obligation. They say in the legislation, oh, we're going to provide public access to the bison range.
They don't have to.
They don't have to. You're right. They don't have to meet federal statutory requirements. They don't have to meet U.S. constitutional requirements.
They don't have to maintain the herd.
They don't have to do anything because the primary purpose of restoring, use the word restoration, which is an interesting word because it's taking something and bringing it back in time to what it was before.
But that's never really what happens. You hear the word restoration, your wallet should run and hide, because what that really means is we're going to restore it to a place we think it should have been, which means we'll never get there, and you're going to get to pay for it forever.
Right, but it's also becoming part of the reservation again, okay, which means that if anything happens on that piece of land, you're subject to tribal, you may be subject to tribal court.
That's true. I forgot about that part. Another bonus.
So there's legal implications here. You know, if you do something they don't like, they can haul you right into court. They can put you in an Indian jail.
Yeah, your constitutional rights are basically suspended.
Well, that's the problem with the tribal members themselves.
Mm-hmm.
Since Indians are not covered by the 14th Amendment to the United States Constitution, Congress came up with a fix. It's called the Indian Civil Rights Act of 68. The problem with that is it gives the tribal council discretion and does not require them to recognize all Bill of Rights of their tribal members. They have an abridged Bill of Rights as Americans.
Hmm. So these people that own property on the reservation, are they subject to the Indian law if they own private property within that reservation?
They can have roads blocked on them, even though they own the property. The Indians will own the roads.
Mm.
Okay? It's happened already. There are just lawsuits on this, where somebody had a home. It was actually a member of the Crow. Was it the Crow tribe or the Blackfoot tribe that owned a home that they had been converted into a vacation setting? And they were blocked from ingress and egress because the tribe took control over the roads. Everything becomes much more difficult. And since this tribe loves to assert itself and to intimidate people when things don't go their way, it makes for a very difficult environment, I am told by locals.
Right.
See, and you have the same thing. There are people who have private property inside land that's managed by BLM or another federal agency, which means you have an easement to get to your property, But I can think of an instance up in Oregon where they wanted this lady off the property. She wouldn't sell. So they just keep changing the lock on the gate. So she'll come back from getting groceries or something in Medford, and she's out of town a ways, gets to the gate, finds there's a new lock. They're required to give her a key, but she has to be able to get back to Medford to the BLM office before 5 o'clock to get the key in order to get back to her house.
Wow.
So, I mean.
But at least in a case like that, your constitutional rights aren't suspended because.
Your ownership is. The ownership of your private property is at the whim of an agency. So, I mean, this by extension is by the whim of the tribe.
But on Indian ground, on a reservation, pretty much all your rights are suspended, aren't they? I mean, because they're a sovereign nation, so they don't.
It's true. I mean, but let's say if there's a federal crime committed on a reservation, the feds will come in.
Sure.
Otherwise, there's likely some type of agreement between the tribe and the state to have joint jurisdiction, and then they may divide down what issues each police force covers.
Right.
I mean, it is a matter of state law, this criminal law, but it also is covered by the tribe. So if you have a crime committed by one tribal member against another, and it's within the reservation, 99% is going to end up in tribal court, not in state court or federal court. Okay? But here's a non-criminal aspect. Okay, Mission Valley Power is the power company that sells the power to those on the reservation, both tribal and non-tribal members. If you have a problem with your bill, or if you want to go get information about this Mission Valley Power, you have a grievance, guess what? You have to contact the Bureau of Indian Affairs, ultimately.
It's almost as good as the California Public Utilities Commission.
Okay, well those people are communists.
I rest my case.
Well, it's both communal living.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's. I feel sorry for Montanans living on the reservation, especially since they work so hard. They put their heart and soul into what they do, and they keep on having to deal with these nefarious characters that say they're their neighbors, but they work behind the scenes against them, and it ultimately, redounds to the favor of the tribe. I mean, ultimately, though, the federal government is the one pulling all the strings here. The federal government owns the water. The federal government exercises these water rights, these Federal Reserve water rights, at will, and lets the tribe have the equitable beneficiary interest, which is, you know, they don't own the land. It's not on their balance sheet. It's on the federal government balance sheet.
Right.
Wow. Well, we have like 30 seconds left here at this point, so we don't just cut you off. I wanted to thank both you guys for coming on. Skip, you kind of jumped in the back seat there, and Larry's been driving, but...
I've been listening.
Good call. Thanks, both you guys. We really appreciate it, and we will put any updates that you send us, we'll put on the page for April 19th, 2020, and you can find it at wethepeopleradio.us.
That justice is the one thing you should always find. You got to saddle up your boys. You've got to draw a hard line. When the gun smoke settles, we'll sing a victory tune, and we'll all meet back at the local saloon. We'll raise up our glasses against evil forces, singing whiskey for my men, beer for my horses.